You're listening to Pastor Bill Surjack at Montreat Conference Center, sharing perspectives on C.S. Lewis's life and conversion. This is Sermon Gold.
I thought I'd just give you a little bit of a feel, the way Lewis writes, and a little bit about the kind of personality he was just here at the beginning, in a couple of his letters. Some of the letters of Lewis, you get to look inside of his personality a little bit more. This is one of my favorites. He was given an invitation to join the Society for the Prevention of Progress, Walnut Creek, California. Here's Lewis's reply in accepting the position of membership in the Society for the Prevention of Progress. While feeling that I was born a member of your society, I am nevertheless honored to receive the outward seal of membership. I shall hope by continued orthodoxy and the unremittent practice of reaction, obstruction, and stagnation to give you no reason for repenting of your favor. I humbly submit that in my Rydell lectures entitled The Abolition of Man, you will find another work not unworthy of consideration for admission to the canon. A lot of Lewis's letters, you begin to see a little bit of the humor of the man. You see some of that in his other works. Here's another one that he writes to his brother back in 1940. I never told you a curious thing which provides an incidence of the malignity of little people. I was going into town one day and got as far as the gate when I realized that I had odd shoes on, one of them clean and the other dirty. I've had black and brown ones on the times, but this is the problem where he had one clean shoe and one dirty shoe. There was no time to go back, and as it was impossible to clean the dirty one, I decided that the only way of making myself look less ridiculous was to dirty the clean one. Now, would you have believed that this is an impossible operation? You can, of course, get some mud on it, but it remains obviously a clean shoe that has had an accident and won't look in the least like the shoe you have been for a walk in. One discovers new snags and catches in life every day. A little bit about just the feeling of the life of Lewis. This is from a book, The Letters of C.S. Lewis. There are several books. Lewis's material is being put together in different ways. I'll be using mostly the ones that are kind of the old line ones that I have. You see most of my books are kind of old on Lewis. Just a little bit of a way that I first started reading Lewis. I grew up totally outside the church. Now, most people who had a little church background don't appreciate what it is to be totally outside the church. I mean, like, as far as I can remember until I was 18 years old, I went to a Catholic church when my grandfather died and saw the inside of the church building for the first time when I was about 8 years old. When I was in the seventh grade, a friend of mine went to a Sunday school class in a Presbyterian church, as I remember now. And that was the second time I ever went inside of a church. And I went to his Sunday school class for a little while. I really, when I became a Christian, didn't know anything. You know, I didn't know there was an Old and New Testament. I didn't know Joseph had a coat of many colors. You know, all that stuff, all the people who've grown up in the church get to know as you're going along. As a matter of fact, they told me about the Bible, and I thought that was the only way that you could ever learn anything about the Christian faith, was to read the Bible. And so I was reading the Bible, and then this girl that I was dating a little at the University of Miami, I was an engineering student, and she gave me a book called Mere Christianity. It was all about C.S. Lewis telling about what it is to be a Christian. And it just blew me away. I didn't realize that Christians wrote books about their faith. And so I read it through quick once, and then I repeated reading it through four or five times. I was just amazed that he could put together the Christian faith in systematic form. And so I thought, well, maybe he wrote something else. At that time, I figured he was the only Christian writer that ever wrote about the Christian faith. And so I went to the University of Miami bookstore, where I bought most of my books, and there wasn't anything else by C.S. Lewis there. But I went out to the airport bookstore, and the airport bookstore at the Miami International Airport also has Screwtape Letters. And I read it again. I thought, maybe this is the same guy. And when I started reading it, sure enough, it seemed the same guy. And I read that through about four or five times. So that was the beginning of the way I started putting my Christian faith together. Now, I wouldn't necessarily recommend that, because I'm a pastor in a Presbyterian church in Tulsa, but I've always been kind of an oddball pastor. I don't really think the way most pastors tend to think. And I'm beginning to realize that part of that was because of the way I was introduced to the faith. In the church, we tend to think in propositions. And that's the way preachers tend to preach, in propositional form. Certain truths about the faith. There are certain words that we use rather regularly. Words like redemption. Words like sanctification. Words like glorification. We all know what the words mean, sort of. And we kind of come in that way. Now, I came in from an engineering background with no church background, and C.S. Lewis being the only one who was telling me a little bit about the faith. And Lewis didn't read theologians. He was a literary teacher. Medieval literature was his specialty at Oxford. He was an instructor for most of his life. And he thought of his Christian faith in literary terms. I tended to think then of my Christian faith much more in literary terms that I picked up from Lewis and mechanical terms. I grew up on a farm in western Pennsylvania. My wife still kind of wonders why I don't like to plant flowers. She said, well, you were a farmer. Well, I never really dug in the dirt. I ran machinery and fixed machinery that dug in the dirt. From my early experience, was kind of a mechanical way of thinking. And so my Christian faith tends to fit into a literary and a mechanical way of thinking. And many times people wonder why I think the way I do. And only recently, I've been in the presbytery for 22 years, and recently the people are beginning to say, oh, yeah, I see where you're coming from. And I see how that works. My faith works well with particularly people outside the church. I do a radio show in Silva where people just call in and ask questions. And it works real well with people outside the church. But inside the church, sometimes I don't click as well with people. My first minister that I had was a man named Ben Hayden, and Ben had some of the same kind of problems as he grew up outside the church and became a Christian. And Ben used to refer to it, he said, Christians are an acquired taste. I mean, and I've learned to acquire it over the years. And now I really enjoy coming to things like this. And sometimes people have trouble reading Lewis. And I think part of the reason they have trouble reading Lewis is they have a certain way of thinking that they're used to inside the church. And Lewis isn't that way. Lewis is almost like reading Dostoevsky or something like that. And you start seeing the Christian faith around it a lot more. And he tends to talk a lot more in pictures than he does in propositions, although he uses the propositions, particularly in his early writings. Okay, I'll give you in a little while an outline of Lewis's life. For right now, we'll just look at a couple of the things that'll give you a little bit more of an understanding, I think, of what the outline means as we get to it. Lewis was born in Belfast, Ireland. His family was Presbyterian. He's an Anglican later in his life. His family background, all the way back, his family were Presbyterians. He had a very happy early childhood, up until about the age of, it was 8 or 9, when his mother died. And he was very close to his mother. They had a very, very loving, very close relationship, and it seemed to have carried over. Even later, Lewis's relationship with his mother's family was much closer than he was with his father's family. He always wrote fondly of his mother's family and kind of tended to poke fun a little bit more at his father's family and some of their little idiosyncrasies, which some of them were pretty severe. And his father was a distant man. He was a man of words. Well, it seemed like when they would start to talk, he would start a conversation with his father. He would say something, and then his father would say, oh, yes, I know what you mean. Then he'd go off and describe everything that Lewis obviously meant. He never really listened to Lewis very well. They had a distant relationship. The children, the boys were not allowed in their father's library, in their father's office. That was an off-limits place. So they ended up playing a lot in the attic and making up stories. And Lewis would say later on, partially because he wrote Christian books, he was never real popular among the faculty and the administration at Oxford. You never wrote outside of your field. His field was medieval literature, and he should not have been writing about Christian faith. If he was in religion, he might have been able to write about Christian faith. But he was not real popular there either. He remained an instructor. He never became a full professor until later in his life when Cambridge had offered him a full professorship, and so Oxford offered him one too to stay. But he went to Cambridge instead. And part of the reason was the type of things that he was writing and the fact that he was writing in the Christian faith. Lewis would say that it did him much good. And I think in looking back on even the fact that his father was distant and it ended up he and his brother were playing, made up a lot of stories about life that they had in the attic. And you can see a lot of that influence coming back then into what I would say were some of Lewis's stronger works, the Chronicles of Narnia, were very strong influences that you can see coming back into some of what was inside of his life coming out. Give you a little bit of an idea of the distance of Lewis's father. During World War I, Lewis was a soldier in the war. His good friend Paddy Moore and he went off to war together. He and Paddy made a pact with each other that if either of them died in the war, the other would take care of the parents of the one who died. As it turned out, Paddy Moore did die in the war. And C.S. Lewis ended up taking care of Paddy Moore's mother for many, many years. She actually lived in the home with Lewis. But during the war, Lewis was wounded and was in a hospital in London, and he had written his father asking him that his father would please come visit him while he was in the hospital. He was homesick, and he'd written his father back in Belfast. His father didn't come. He was in a hospital in London just a few hours really by boat away for 8 months, and his father never came to visit him during that whole time. And here's one of the letters that he wrote to his father. Ever since my last visit to you, I've been almost daily expecting to hear from you. I am rather surprised that neither my answer to your proposal nor my suggestion that you should come over here has met with any reply. Have you not yet decided for a date on coming over? It's 4 months now since I returned from France, and my friends laughingly suggest that my father in Ireland is a mythical creation like Mrs. Arias. I hope there's nothing wrong and that I shall soon hear from you again. As it turned out, his father never did come over there. In Lewis, he had that distant relationship with his father. He went to boarding schools, as is very common practice in England at that time, but he didn't do very well in the boarding school. He seems to indicate a homosexual difficulty of the boys who were homosexual approaching him. It never really says anything very deeply about that, but he was real turned off by the boys' schools. And his father let him go and stay with the man who had been his father's tutor, W.T. Kirkpatrick. W.T. Kirkpatrick became an influence in Lewis in his early teaching, in preparing him to become a student at Oxford. In Lewis's book, Surprised by Joy, he talks a little bit about W.T. Kirkpatrick. Surprised by Joy is a book that is Lewis's spiritual journey. It tells a little bit about how he came to faith in Jesus Christ, and a little bit about his life and his background. People sometimes think that his wife, Joy Davidman, must have been where the name of the title came from, but it was actually written a long time before he knew anything of Joy Davidman. And this is the way he described W.T. Kirkpatrick, who was to have a powerful influence on Lewis, though certainly not in a Christian direction. Here's the way he described him. This is when he came to the Brookham train station, and he met W.T. Kirkpatrick for the first time as a relatively young boy. He was about 12 or 13 years old when he first met Kirkpatrick. And here's how he described him. He was over 6 feet tall, very shabbily dressed, like a gardener, I thought, lean as a rake and immensely muscular. His wrinkled face seemed almost entirely of muscles, so far as was visible. For he wore a mustache and side whiskers and a clean-shaven chin like the Emperor Franz Joseph. The whiskers, you will understand, concerned me very much at that moment. My cheek already tingled in anticipation. Would he begin at once? He was afraid he was going to hug him, what it was. And there would be tears for certain, perhaps worse things. It was one of my lifelong weaknesses that I could never endure the embrace of my own sex. An unmanly weakness, by the way. Arius Beowulf, Roland, Lancelot, Johnson, and others knew nothing of it. You can see that in the movie, if you saw the movie Shadowlands. When Joy Davidman died and he was trying to comfort her son, he had a very difficult time touching or hugging. That was just a part of what he was about coming out of his childhood. Apparently, however, the old man was holding his fire. We shook hands, and though his grip was like iron pincers, it was not lingering. A few moments later, we were walking away from the station. You are now, said Kirk, proceeding along the principal artery between Great and Little Bookham. I stole a glance at him. Was this geographical exordium a heavy joke, or was he trying to conceal his emotions? His face, however, showed only an inflexible gravity. I began to make conversation in the deplorable manner which I had acquired in those evening parties, and indeed found increasingly necessary to use with my father. I said I was surprised at the scenery of Surrey. It was much wilder than I had expected. Stop, shouted Kirk, with a suddenness that made me jump. What do you mean by wildness? On what grounds were you expecting it? I replied that I still didn't know, still making conversation. As answer after answer was torn to shreds, it at least dawned upon me that he really wanted to know. He was not making conversation or joking or snubbing me. He wanted to know. I was stung into attempting a real answer. A few passes sufficed to show that I had no clear and distinct idea corresponding to the word wildness, and that insofar as I had any idea at all, wildness was a singularly inept word. Do you not see, then concluded the great Knock, that your remark was meaningless? I prepared to sulk a little, assuming that the subject would now be dropped. Never was I more mistaken in my life. Having analyzed my terms, Kirk was proceeding to deal with my proposition as a whole. But on what I had based, what he had pronounced advised, my expectations about flora and geology of Surrey, was it maps or photographs or books? I could produce none. It had, heaven help me, never occurred to me that my thoughts needed to be biased on anything. Kirk once more drew a conclusion, without the slightest sign of emotion, but equally without the slightest concession to what I thought good manners. Do you not see, then, that you had no right to have any opinion whatever on the subject? Kirk was that kind of a personality. He absolutely insisted on the use of the right word, and he absolutely insisted on you having some idea of why you were saying what you were saying. You couldn't just make conversation with Kirk. Kirk also was an atheist. He was the one who, what little faith that Lewis had in his childhood, Kirk was able to quickly extinguish in his life. Kirk was able to move him away from faith in Jesus Christ or any kind of Christian faith that he might have had. That was the way he continued then for several years. He became an atheist under the influence of Kirk, and then as he went into Oxford, first as a student, then later as a professor, he remained an atheist. As a matter of fact, there's a book, Letters, that Lewis wrote to his friend Arthur Greeley, and he was a Christian. It's interesting in the book because at the beginning of the book, Greeley is a Christian and Lewis is an atheist. And he's responding back, ridiculing some of the things that Arthur is saying. And then later on, Lewis becomes a Christian. And the amazing thing that happens is that Greeley starts drifting more and more into Rastafarianism and also what we would call New Age today. In the spiritualism, he kind of drifts away. And then Lewis is trying to write to his old friend to win him back to Orthodox Christianity. So it's an interesting exchange. I think the title of the book, They Stand Together, if you happen to see it in a bookstore anytime, it'd be worth picking up. Well, Lewis grew up with the idea of his Christian faith, the way he looked at things was through his head. When I saw the movie Shadowlands, most people cried at the end of the movie when Joy Davidman gets cancer and starts to die. I started crying all the way earlier in the movie. I realized that one of the reasons I liked Lewis so well was I think we had some of the similar neuroses. I tended to start, after a while, because of the kind of childhood I have, start living my life more through my head. I approach things almost completely with my mind. My parents also were people who didn't touch. It was also very awkward for me whenever anybody would touch me or any kind of a physical relationship. So much so that my uncle, who was very perceptive, when he saw me, he hadn't seen me from the time I was 16 years old until the time when I was in my early 30s. And he was really surprised at me. He told my wife afterwards, he said, Bill isn't anything like what he should be. Part of the reason was that my daughter and I were very affectionate. My wife and I were very affectionate. I had a completely different kind of a personality. What Uncle Bill didn't realize was that in between, I had had another family. I'd become a Christian and had a church family that was very affectionate and very loving in that way. And that began to change me. And so I have a special appreciation for Lewis and some of the things that he went through. I think I went through a lot of the same things. And I saw him on the screen in Shadowlands, and I realized Anthony Hopkins did a pretty good portrayal of the personality of Lewis. There's a lot of historical things that weren't quite accurate. But the feelings of Lewis and Joy Davidman and the whole relationship, I think, was very powerfully and very well portrayed. But Lewis, he had entered Oxford, and his father died. I think this is part of the process, really, of him beginning to have a new father, a heavenly father. As he became a Christian internally. And it was, I think, a very slow process then for him to begin to express what he was becoming on the new side in his faith that was internal, beginning to express it on the outside. And this is him describing his father. There was a distance in the relationship with his father, but he desired a closeness, which you can pick up here. I could, if we had another hour, I could explain a similar thing that was in my own life and my relationship with my father. He's writing here his brother, because Lewis had been with his father right near the time of his death, and his brother was away. His brother was a soldier, Warney was a soldier, and was often away. And here he is describing a little bit about what their father was like right near the death. Up until the end, one of the best things that he said was 4 days before his death. As I came in, the day nurse said, I've just been telling Mr. Lewis that he's exactly like my father, Pappy. And how am I like your father, nurse? Well, he's a pessimist. Pappy, after a pause, I suppose he has several daughters. Pappy was Lewis's father, was not very fond of daughters. As the time goes on, the thing emerges is that whatever else he was a terrific personality. You remember, Johnson is dead, let us go to the next. There is none other. No one can be said to put you in mind of Johnson, how he filled the room, how hard it was to realize that physically he was not a big man. On the whole, our world is neither direct nor indirect testimony to the same facts. The way we enjoyed going to Little Lee, the way we hated it, the way we enjoyed hating it. As you say, one can't grasp that that is over. And now you can do anything you cared in the study at midday on Sunday, and it's beastly. Since his father had died, he was now able to go into his father's study, and it was beastly to go in there. There was the emptiness in that relationship that never got fulfilled with his father. A close, caring style, nurturing relationship just was not there for Lewis. And I don't think it was there until God came into his life. And I think really someone who is particularly a male who's a aggressive, non-nurturing kind of personality, it takes someone aggressive to begin to break through. And so the way Lewis pictured God was aggressive, because that's the way God worked on him internally. He was very aware of God aggressively coming to him. In the book Miracles, he explains a little bit of that kind of a picture. It is always shocking to meet life where one thought we were alone. Look out, we cry, it's alive. And therefore, at this very point at which so many draw back, I would have done so myself if I could and proceed no farther with Christianity. An impersonal God, well and good. A subjective God of beauty and truth and goodness inside our own heads, better still. A formless life force surging through us. A vast power which we can tap, best of all. but got himself, alive, pulling at the other end of the cord, perhaps approaching at an infinite speed, the hunter, the king, the husband, that is quite another matter. There comes a time when the children who have been playing at burglars hush suddenly. Was that a real footstep in the hall? There comes a moment when people who have been dabbling in religion, man's search for God, suddenly draw back. Supposing we really found him. We never meant it to come to that. Worse still, supposing he had found us. And I think that's pretty much the way it worked for Lewis in his conversion. God found him. God reached down into the depths of his soul, and he had to start dealing with a God that he had kind of put into a nice logical pattern that would fit into his world. But now he suddenly had to deal with a living God who was a real person. And part of the people that helped him do that were a group that he went to in Oxford. He wrote to his father one time saying he was surprised how many Christians he kept bumping into at Oxford. And it was, I think, again, that was more the aggressiveness of God who was working on Lewis. But one of the groups that he worked with, you may have heard about it, is the Inklings. It was a group of people in Oxford. The primary thing was to read each other's stuff. Orny, Lewis's brother, was in the group. Owen Barfield, J.R.R. Tolkien was there. Hugo Dyson, Holland Haiti, Adam Fox, Robert Harvard, Charles Williams, who was also quite a great writer in his own right, and a man named Charles Wren, another writer. They would meet together in the Child and Eagle pub, and they would read each other's stuff. I've often wished for a group like that. We have these pastoral support groups. It's usually like, well, how are you feeling? And how are you feeling? And it's good to share our feelings with each other, but I like to sometimes be able to get together and share ideas like that. And that's what they had in this group. It was like an idea-sharing thing. They critiqued each other's stuff. And Tolkien, who wrote the Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, very well-known stories now, member of the group, he was a Catholic Christian and had a powerful influence on Lewis becoming a Christian. And they had the opportunity of critiquing each other, and they were willing to talk openly and even defy each other to a certain point. It was a group that helped Lewis begin to come to faith in Christ. The Inklings, just to give you a little flavor of what they were like, this is later on, this is after Lewis has become a Christian, it gives you an idea of how they worked back and forth with each other. I had a pleasant evening on Thursday with Williams, Tolkien, and Wren, during which Rand expressed almost seriously a strong desire to burn Williams, or at least the conversation with Williams enabled him to understand how the Inquisitors had felt it right to burn people. The occasion was a discussion of the most distressing text in the Bible, "Narrow is the way, and few there be that find it," and whether one could really believe in a universe where the majority were damned, and also in the goodness of God. Rand, of course, took the view that it mattered precisely nothing whether it conformed to our ideas of goodness or not, and it was at this stage that the combustible possibilities of Williams revealed themselves to him in an attractive light. The general sense of the meeting was in favor of our view taken in the Pastorum, that our Lord's replies are never straight answers and never gratify curiosity. Whatever this one meant, its purpose was certainly not statistical. But they worked off each other's minds. This also helped Lewis come to faith in Christ, because he was a person who was mainly mental at this time. And so he needed to come to Christ in kind of a mental way. I think God tends to meet us in the way we are. He then changes us, but he tends to meet us where we are. He had to meet Lewis mentally, and that's the way Lewis came to faith in Christ. The coming together of that happened on a motorcycle ride. He was riding in a sidecar on a motorcycle to Whipsnap Zoo, and it was like things clicked together in his head. Some people have very powerful emotional experiences when they become Christian. Lewis, it wasn't that way. I can understand that, too, because it's the same way with me when I became a Christian. First time someone explained to me about sin and about what Jesus did on the cross and how I have to put my faith in what Jesus did. And I said, makes sense. Seems reasonable. Seems logical. I believe it. I became the faith in Christ. Now, that was the beginning of a portion of my Christian journey, but the significant point in it. Then God worked to bring out the rest of it. That's the way I found out later it happened with Lewis. He was talking about his taking the final step of putting faith in Christ. I was driven to Whipsnade Zoo on one Sunday morning. When we set out, I did not believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. And when we reached the zoo, I did. Yet I had not exactly spent the journey in thought, nor in great emotion. Emotional is the last word I can apply to it, or most of the important events. It was more like when a man, after a long sleep, still lying motionless in bed, becomes aware that he is now awake. One of the people who put together books about Lewis is A Mind Awake. Just sort of came awake to the reality of God. And it then began to grow in his life, to take over a good bit later on. He records that in more of a visual way in one of the Chronicles of Narnia, The Horse and His Boy. If you haven't read the Chronicles of Narnia, they're children's fairy tales but probably some of the best theology that I've ever read. But they're different than normal theology. They're not systematic theology or putting together precepts, but they're visual pictures of the Christian faith. And this one, I think, is Lewis's story about his own life, about his own conversion. And in this one, the horse and his boy, the horse is a talking horse in Narnia, so it has personality. It could just as easily be a horse and his boy as well as a boy and his horse. It was like they were kind of companions rather than a boy who was leading a horse. But Shasta has gone through a whole difficult journey up until this one point. He's been lost in the desert and been chased by a lion to be able to get his way through the desert. He was in a cemetery and there was wolves, coyotes howling about him, and a lion came by and drove out the coyotes. Then later, as he was still nervous in a cemetery, a little kitten curled up next to him. There was all these instances of a lion in his early life. They were on a journey to reach King Lune to be able to warn him about the evil darkness that was approaching on the castle of Caer Paravel. Immediately after Shasta got there, King Lune and the rest of his soldiers rushed right away back to the castle to protect it. Shasta was now, instead of riding a Narnian horse, he was riding a regular horse that he had a guide, and he couldn't do it, and he couldn't get the horse going, and so he kept getting further and further behind everyone. And he was riding along in the darkness, and he was just feeling kind of sorry for himself. He was having, I guess, a pity attack, a pathetic attack is what Andrew calls him. Then he sensed this presence next to him. As Lewis described it, something that was breathing on a very large scale, and it made him nervous. He didn't know what it was. And then finally, this conversation goes on between Shasta and the thing. "Who are you?" he said, scarcely above a whisper. "One who has waited long for you to speak," said the thing. Its voice was not loud, but very large and deep. Are you a giant?" asked Shasta. "You might call me a giant," said the large thing, "but I'm not like the creatures you call giants." Here Lewis is playing again on words, because the early words that the Hebrews used to describe God was Elohim and El Shaddai, and they mean basically giant, something that's real big and huge. And so Aslan answers back, "You might call me a giant, but I'm not like the creatures you call giants." "I can't see you at all," said Shasta, after staring very hard. Then for an even more terrible idea came into his head. He said almost in a scream, "You're not something dead, are you? Oh, please, please go away. What harm have I ever done you? Oh, I am the unluckiest person in the whole world." Once more, he felt the warm breath of the thing in his hand and face. "There," it said, "that's not the breath of a ghost. Tell me your sorrows." Shasta was a little reassured by the breath, so he told how he had never known his real father or mother, and had been brought up sternly by the fishermen. He told the story of his escape and how they were chased by lions and forced to swim for their lives, and of all their dangers in Tashban, and about his night among the tombs, and how the beast had howled at him out of the desert. And he told of the heat and the thirst of their desert journey, and how they were almost to their goal when another lion chased them and wounded Erephus, and also how very long it had been to have anything to eat. "I do not call you unfortunate," said the large voice. "Don't you think it was bad luck to meet so many lions?" "There was only one lion," said the voice. "What on earth do you mean? I've told you that first night there were at least two." "There was only one, but he was foot to foot." "How do you know?" "I was the lion." And as Shasta gaped with open mouth and said nothing, the voice continued, "I was the lion who forced you to join with Erephus. I was the cat who comforted you among the houses of the dead. I was the lion who drove the jackals from you while you slept. I was the lion who gave the horses the new strength of fear for the last mile so you could reach King Lune in time. And I was the lion you do not remember who pushed the boat in which you lay a child near death so that it came to shore where the man sat wakeful at midnight to receive you. Then it was you who wounded Erephus. It was I. But what for?" "Child," said the voice, "I am telling you your story, not hers. Tell no one anyone's story but their own." That's an important concept, I think, in the Christian faith. God will explain our own story to us, but he won't explain generally why bad things happen to good people. Like for me, I have not had very many bad things happen to me in my life, but one of the things that was real hard for me was when I was a teenager, I had acne. I wish the scars you still see a good bit of on my face. Right now, in looking back over my life, probably the best thing that I had when I was a teenager was acne. You couldn't have convinced me of it then, because I thought that was probably about the worst thing that was going on in my life. But by having that, it forced me to look a little bit beneath the surface of people. And it really turned out to be one of the best things that happened to me during that time. And God tells no one anyone's story but their own. He won't necessarily say that to someone else who's going through even a similar kind of a problem. He couldn't say why he wounded Erephus, but he could explain to Erephus why he wounded her. And then finally, "Who are you?" Shasta asked.
"Myself," said the voice, very deep and low, so that the earth shook. And again, "Myself," loud and clear and gay. And then a third time, "Myself," whispered so softly you could hardly hear it. And yet it seemed to come from all around you, as if the leaves wrestled with it. "Myself, myself, myself." When God was asked to name who he was by Moses, he said, "Yahweh, I am who I am. I will be who I will be." It's like we can't picture what God's like, but God can reveal himself to us. Whenever we give our own words for God or our own names for God, they always fall short. But God says, "I am who I am. I will be who I will be." And he reveals himself to us. That's why in my church, when I have a call to worship, usually at the beginning, in some way or other, I said that we have not come to worship the God that we make up out of our own minds or our own ideas of God. We come to worship the God who is revealed to us in Jesus Christ. There's a whole lot of gods being made up today, all kinds of them out there. And the one that we're worshiping in the church, we got to be careful that we don't kind of bring all those gods into our church. When we're worshiping in the church is the one who is revealed in Jesus Christ. But Lewis, on the way to Whipsnade Zoo, becomes a Christian. As he comes into this Christian faith, his early external expression of his Christian faith is still pretty much the way he's always been, which is primarily mental. Here's one of the better illustrations of it. This is in a compilation of books, but one of his books called God in the Dock, which is a series of short essays that Lewis wrote, were put together after his death. They're pretty good ones to have lying around the house. This is a decent book, or in your bathroom. Here's a part of one of his essays called Man or Rabbit. It says, "Can't you lead a good life without believing in Christianity? This is the question which I've been asked to write. And straightway, before I begin trying to answer it, I have a comment to make. The question sounds as if it were asked by a person who said, 'I don't care whether Christianity is in fact true or not. I'm not interested in finding out whether the real universe is more like what the Christians say than what the materialists say. All I'm interested in is leading a good life. I'm going to choose beliefs not because I think them true, but because I find them helpful.' Now, frankly, I find it very hard to sympathize with this state of mind. One of the things that distinguishes man from the other animals is that he wants to know things, wants to find out what reality is like, simply for the sake of knowing. When that desire is completely quenched in anyone, I think he has become something less than human. As a matter of fact, I don't believe any of you have really lost that desire. More probably, foolish preachers, by always telling you how much Christianity will help you and how good it is for society, have actually led you to forget Christianity. Forget that Christianity is not patent medicine. Christianity claims to give an account of facts, to tell you what the real universe is like. Its account of the universe may be true or it may not. Once the question is really before you, then your natural inquisitiveness must make you want to know the answer. If Christianity is untrue, then no honest man will want to believe it, however helpful it might be. If it is true, every honest man will want to believe it, even if he gives them no help at all." Lewis took this absolutely brilliant mind that he had and applied it to his Christian faith. That's the way his Christian faith operated for years and years, mainly on the mental. We owe him a tremendous debt of gratitude for using that literary, wonderful mind to be able to put these things together in a way that maybe is a little bit different than most of us would come to. But Lewis also, in his own life, despite the fact that he was Christian, was also moving to a personal kind of a crisis. One of the books that he had written got a particularly bad review, and Lewis went into a time of writer's block. He didn't write too much of anything, and particularly in the Christian faith, because a writer who probably, again, understood very well the propositional truth and a propositional approach to the Christian faith did not see where Lewis was coming from with the way he did things, and said Lewis ought to quit writing about the Christian faith and ought to stick to his own expertise. And it really struck Lewis deeply in his deep chord in his life, and he, for several years, just quit writing. He would write letters. He wrote some literary works at that time. And he also wrote to Father Dom Giovanni Galboria, who was like a father confessor to him. If you read a book called The Latin Letters of Lewis, Lewis and Father Giovanni wrote to each other in Latin. Fortunately, they're translated. I don't read them in Latin. At one time, this was right before he met Joy Davidman, when he was in the middle of his writer's block, he wrote this to his father confessor. "I would not wish to deceive you with vain hope. I am now in my 50th year." Those of us who have passed that know that those are dangerous years. Those are tough years to get through. "I am now in my 50th year. I feel my zeal for writing and whatever talent I originally possessed to be decreasing. Nor do I believe I please my readers as I used to. I labor under many difficulties. My house is unquiet and devastated by women's quarrels. I have to dwell in the tents of Kedar. My aged mother, worn out by long infirmity, is my daily care. Pray for me, Father, that I even bear in my mind the profoundly true maxim that if thou wish to bring peace to others, keep thyself in peace. Lewis's household was very difficult at that time. He was taking care of Patty Moore's mother, Mrs. Moore, who was an extremely difficult woman, very contentious. His friends and the Inklings wouldn't even come to Lewis's house because they didn't want to have to deal with Mrs. Moore. She was that difficult to deal with. And Lewis kept his promise, patiently kept taking care of Patty Moore's mother. But Lewis also, in his own life, was moving to a personal crisis. And also his writing was just not going well, or he didn't think it was going well. This is also a warning to some of us, particularly as we've reached that age where we think, you know, we don't have very much to offer anymore. Our culture is very much of a youth-oriented culture. And I'm 55 years old, and usually people don't want to listen to an old guy very much anymore. But one of the things you notice about Lewis is that at this point, he thought he had pretty well finished his writing career. The interesting thing was that he wrote all of his best stuff after that. He wrote almost all of the Chronicles of Narnia after that. He wrote Till We Have Faces, which Lewis himself called his best work, considerably after that. His relationship with Joy Davidman, and also a beginning of a coming out of his relationship with God, began to take hold. Also at that time, Mrs. Moore got unusually ill and went into a nursing home. Within a month or so later, he got his first letter from Joy Davidman, and they began the correspondence. And it was almost like there was a new life beginning to come out in Lewis. He had that closeness of that relationship with Joy Davidman began to take place. It helped in many ways to begin to bring out the expression of who he was. Joy Davidman was a brilliant woman. As I mentioned to some people earlier, she was Jewish, the daughter of a psychiatrist, she was a communist, and she was divorced from her first husband. So, you know, you wouldn't expect that this would be the person that Lewis would marry. She had become a Christian, mainly through some of Lewis's writings, and her life was beginning to change. If you happen to saw the movie Shadowlands, she had come to England, she was writing a book, and this was the book I think she was writing, The Ten Commandments. In my opinion, it's still the best book I've read in The Ten Commandments. Here's one of the things she says about The Ten Commandments. Give you an idea of the insight of this woman's mind. We are crying out to be rescued from the deadly terrors of the world we have made. Peace of mind, peace of soul, peace of heart. Our spiritual leaders promise them all. And we, for whom there is no peace, snatch at them in our bewilderment and despair. God, for many of us, is a life preserver flung to a drowning man. And so he is, if you happen to be drowning. But you can't drown all the time. Sooner or later, you have to start merely living again. You reach shore, sputter the water out of your lungs, and then what? Throw away the life preserver. I can see how a lot of times in our churches, particularly, we've had this wonderful experience of being rescued by God, being rescued out of sin, and then we almost want to keep recreating the wonder of that rescue. And we keep getting ourselves into deeper and deeper difficulties and then pray, God, please rescue me. And we get this rescuing kind of mentality. And Joy Davidman was saying that you have to realize there comes a time where you just go on with normal living. I always compare it to Mary and Joseph. Can you imagine what happened in their life at Bethlehem? This unbelievable, you know, this child was born that had been promised. Angels came. Hosannas were sung. Shepherds came to worship the child. It must have been an absolutely unbelievable couple of weeks. And then they went home. They had to flee to Egypt for a while. And there was a time when Jesus came to the temple at 12 years old when he astounded the people of the temple. But then not much happened. It was ordinary life. And part of the Christian faith is we have to begin to learn to live out ordinary life. And I think the relationship that Lewis had with Joy Davidman, you could see it very well. I think that was the best part of the movie Shadowlands, is the way it portrayed, the way you could see Lewis beginning to openly express his love for Joy Davidman, for the way that began to bring out all of that internal feelings that had been there all of his life, that God had reached inside and touched, but now it was beginning to come out in a much more powerful effect. And then there was a short time that they had in their life together. They were able to make a trip to Greece. The movie, I think, portrayed it as a trip in the northern part of England, but it was really a trip to Greece that they went on. First of all, as they had been married in a civil ceremony, just so Joy Davidman or Joy Gresham, her name at that time, could stay in England. They were married in a civil ceremony. And then it isn't portrayed in the movie, and you seldom read about it, but there was an Anglican priest, the Reverend Peter Bide, who laid hands on Joy and prayed for her. And Lewis really attributed her remission from cancer much more to the prayer, I think, than he did to the radiation treatment that she also had. But she did have a remission right after the laying on of hands and the praying, and Lewis, by this time, had already realized that he was in love with Joy Gresham. Peter Bide also married them in a church ceremony, and so that they were married again before the Lord, not just before the state. They had about 3 years together, and then Joy Lewis, her cancer, comes back again, and she dies. And that's a powerful time in Lewis's life. You can imagine this confirmed bachelor, this man who had lived a mental life, late in his life, came to love this woman, came to come to a point where his life was coming out again. And then suddenly she was gone. And it was a devastating time for Lewis. And that was when he wrote another very popular book, and a very different book than anything else Lewis wrote, A Grief Absurd. And in this one, he just writes about what he felt like. Matter of fact, when he first wrote the book, he wrote it under a pseudonym. He used his mother's maiden name as the name of the writer. As it turned out, he was going through such a hard time at Oxford. This book was published while he was still going through that hard time at Oxford. And his friends started giving him the book to help him get through his difficulties. And then he finally had to admit that he had written the book. Then it was published again under his name. But you see, he went through a time where this man who had been so brilliant at being able to put together and understand the faith went through a time when he could just barely believe it. I'd like to read just a little bit from that, give you just a little feel of this. It's right near the end. He was responding to how people say that she's in God's hands now. Don't worry about it. Because she is in God's hands. But if so, she was in God's hands all the time. And I have seen what they did to her. Do they suddenly become gentler at the moment we are out of the body? And if so, why? If God's goodness is inconsistent with hurting us, then either God is not good or there is no God. For if in the only life we have, we know he hurts us beyond our worst fears and beyond all we can imagine. He is consistent with hurting us. Then he may hurt us after death and endurably as before. There's several parts in the early part of the book. You can see this wonderful mind now trying to deal with the feelings of the loss of someone he loves that much. The book is a great journey of grief. As you see at the beginning, he can barely believe in God. And at the end, he comes back to a deeper and a fuller belief in God. I want to do just a couple more. This one is from the Letters to an American Lady. This is after Joy Davidman has died. He's come to the point where he's recovered somewhat of the grief, but he himself now has heart failure. And he's writing to this lady that he's written to for a good bit of her life. As a matter of fact, he said it's one of the few single women who kept writing to him after he married Joy Davidman. So he wondered why some of the others had been writing. This is when he's beginning to become weak. He answered all of his letters, which is a very convicting thing to me. People all over would write him, and he would answer every one of them. He would not keep their letter. He consigned to the flames after 3 months anything that anyone wrote to him, because he didn't want to have people misinterpreting them later, which is probably what we're doing with his letters. But people kept saving his letters, but that enabled us to see some of the things in the books that he see a little bit more of his personal life. And this will give you an idea of near the end of his life, the weakness that he was. Thanks for your letter of the 27th. I am quite comfortable, but very easily tired. So I have all the mail to do. So you must expect my letters to be few and very short, more a wave of the hand than a letter. He still kept trying to keep in touch. Again, a beautiful expression, more a wave of the hand than a letter. And right near the end of Lewis's life, Warney writes of his last day. Incidentally, Lewis died. A lot of times you didn't hear that much about his death because he died on November the 22nd, 1963. And I don't know if you know of anything else that happened on that day. Kennedy was shot on that day. And so Lewis kind of got ignored in his death. Oh, he also wasn't nearly as well known when he died as he is now. Friday the 22nd of November began much as other days. There was breakfast, then letters, he was writing his return letter, the crossword puzzle, which he enjoyed doing. After lunch, he fell asleep in his chair. I suggested that he would be more comfortable in bed, and he went there. At 4, I took his tea and found him drowsy but comfortable. Our few words then were the last. At 5:30, I heard a crash and ran in to find him lying unconscious at the foot of the bed. He ceased to breathe some 3 or 4 minutes later. And Lewis died at about the age of 65. And several books from his papers have been published since his death.